KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego, offering the online Master of Data Science program, a journey through computation, data analysis, and real-world applications. Learn more about the online Master of Data Science program from UC San Diego at omds.ucsd.edu.
This week on KPBS Roundtable, we take a look at the state of the U.S. immigration system and the increased role the San Diego-Tijuana border region is playing in it.
The numbers have skyrocketed, you know, the last several years, really since 2019.
All that as a welcome center for migrants closes its doors. We take a look at what that means for asylum seekers arriving in the area.
It looks like it's just going to go back to what it was before, which would be street releases. They're going to be released in transit centers in San Ysidro and North County, most likely.
Plus, other top stories from the week on this week's Roundup. That's ahead on KPBS Roundtable.
Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.
. 2023 ended with a record number of migrant encounters along the U.S.-Mexico border for the month of December. It capped another year of asylum seekers from across the globe navigating an overwhelmed immigration system in the United States. Meanwhile, a bipartisan effort to pass immigration reform failed earlier this month. And closer to home here in the San Diego-Tijuana border region, a local migrant shelter is closing its doors this week, leaving a hole in services for asylum seekers in the region. Here to help us break it all down, I'm joined now by KPBS investigative border reporter Gustavo Solis and Elliot Spaggett, San Diego correspondent and U.S. immigration team lead with the Associated Press. I want to welcome you both back here to Roundtable. And Gustavo, this week, a local migrant welcome center is closing its doors, citing a lack of funding. Tell us about what's been happening there and the role that it's been playing since it opened last fall.
It is not very surprising. I think people knew that the shelter was going to close when it did. And there's a lot of frustration in the community about that. The county spent $6 million on this shelter and, you know, it came and went. And there's no real long-term, there's really nothing to show for it in the long term. Now, while it was open, it did a lot of good. Something like 70,000, 80,000 migrants went through there. And it was a place where we've talked about this before, right? The migrants, asylum seekers who are out in Jacumba, in the between the two border walls of San Ysidro, once they get processed to through Customs and Border Protection, they ended up at that shelter. And it was at that shelter where they would get some food. They'd get access to Wi-Fi to make travel arrangements, and something like 98% of them would leave San Diego and reach their, you know, final destination in the U.S., whether it be L.A., San Francisco, New York, Chicago, whatever have you. But closing that center means that those people will now have nowhere to go, and it looks like it's just going to go back to what it was before, which would be street releases. They're going to be released in transit centers in San Ysidro and North County, most likely. I don't know if you've heard anything other than that.
Correct, yeah. That's the way it was. I think it started in September when the two big shelters in San Diego, Jewish Family Service and Catholic Charities, said they were full. And they were still able to take all the families, but the single adults were getting released. They were temporarily now at this county shelter, and now they'll be back in the streets and having to find their way to the airport, to the bus stations. And I'm sure some NGOs will be, some organizations will be out there trying to help just but without any government support.
Yeah, so we're kind of back to where we started, because those two other shelters are still at capacity. They're still full.
Mm. And you guys touched on it before, but I think we have we heard stories about before Border Patrol would just do these drops at like bus stops and train centers. So was this shelter sort of put in place as an emergency sort of stopgap to kind of stop that from happening and give them more services to kind of go to these other places that you mentioned, Gustavo?
I mean, that's how I viewed it, as a direct response to this, right? Because nobody wanted the street releases. They look chaotic. They put a lot of pressure on local communities. Down in San Ysidro, and I know Oceanside, all of the North County mayors were kind of up in arms about this. It's not safe for the migrants themselves to just be out in the public. There's no, restrooms, shelter, electricity. So it was just a poor situation that neither the migrants nor the communities wanted. And this shelter was meant to be a response to that.
And it wasn't a shelter. It wasn't an overnight shelter.
Sorry, yeah, I should call it Migrant Welcome Center is the official name of it.
I see. Okay. So, Elliot, some of your recent reporting, you wrote about, the number of migrant arrivals, particularly the record highs in December. You quoted a U.S. Customs and Border Patrol official saying it was unprecedented. There was more than 10,000 illegal crossings certain days that month. Can you put that into perspective for us? I mean, how unusual are those numbers, for an ordinary December or even overall in 2023?
It's the numbers have skyrocketed, the last several years, really since 2019. I think in 2017, it was the number of arrests for crossing the border illegally from Mexico were about, 300,000. Maybe it was 300,000. Those were the lowest since the early 1970s, and now we're the last 2 years have been above 2 million in each of the last 2 years. So yeah, some days over 10,000, which is just pretty extraordinary. So the numbers that it dropped. I don't know if you remember back when the COVID-related asylum restrictions expired,
right.
Some new limits went into effect. People were kind of like, "Well, what's this going to look like?" It dropped. 40%, I believe, in June from May when that change happened. And then it just climbed five in the next 6 months to this record high, as you mentioned, 250,000 in December. And then it dropped again in January, about 50% in half.
Tell us about the January numbers. What's behind that?
Yeah. I'm not going to read too much into it because it's 1 month and things go up and down. But apparently they are staying low in February. In San Diego, for example, I was told by the Mexican officials who get the data directly from CBP that it went from there were 1,200 up to 1,200 a day crossing in Jacumba in December, and it dropped to 250 or something. So seasonal factors that Christmas holidays that usually the numbers will drop around that time. Another big issue in the CBP has made a big deal out of this is more cooperation from the Mexican authorities. So their immigration agency said they ran out of money in early December. It raised a lot of alarms in Washington. Secretary Blinken and Mayorkas flew to Mexico City the last week of December and to address this. And around that time, Mexico started resuming deportations, patrolling the freight trains as they come up through Mexico. So probably those two things, Mexico's more enforcement and the seasonal declines.
And I believe there was a Mexican checkpoint put in place near the Jacumba.
Yeah. I haven't been out there, but I saw – I don't know. Have you?
No, I've seen pictures. I've never seen anything like that before on the
I haven't.
Side
it looked it. Really striking because in Jacumba, it's I have been to where the gap where people cross the border there.
Hundreds
of people a day. There's nothing there. The wall, goes out to a – it reaches a certain point where it runs into a mountain. And you could really – it's very easy to get around. You just walk around it. It's just very, very easy. There's nothing stopping kids or older people from getting across. So it's in the – but it's in the middle of – it looks like it's in the middle of a ranch, a very remote ranch. And that's where the Mexican authorities set up this checkpoint.
Yeah, just tents it looks like, almost like a festival-type tents that you would see there.
And has that had an impact on the Jacumba crossings there?
I would imagine just at least a little bit. But as Elliot said, it's a lot of factors, right? Seasonal trends. People don't like to travel as much during the holidays. I imagine weather had something to do with it. It's been really cold, really rainy, which makes it really daunting and difficult and just frankly dangerous to cross at that time. Factored in with Mexico really trying to get on it now as a result of pressure from the U.S. So yeah, I think a whole bunch of issues.
And Hakumba, you know, the areas around, we're talking about this desert community in Hakumba, Hot Springs and thereabouts, it really was a major arrival point for the San Diego region, would you say most of last year or several months of last year? But do you expect that to continue or kind of wait and see?
I don't know if, is there a reason to expect it to go down, right? I mean, a lot of, if you look at the push factors of why migrants are coming, I don't think those have changed significantly. So I don't see it changing. And the way, at least my understanding of migration is once one migration route is established, people tend to kind of use it, right? People are communicating to friends back home. They're on WhatsApp groups talking about their journey. So I feel like once you establish a route, it's very difficult to change it or divert it without a big, big effort. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. The immigration is going to continue. Migration is going to continue. Whether they cross in Hakumba or Campo or El Cajon, I don't think any of us know. The smugglers decide those things. Hakumba was the first time I noticed it was in May, right before the pandemic restrictions, Title 42 lifted, and there was actually a fair amount from Uzbekistan and Turkey, and then Colombia. And there were about 700 people out there at any given time, just camped out there. And it's a very striking place because there's just nothing. It is off the interstate. It's very close to the I-8, but it really is remote. And I've never seen any crossing like it, really. And they're right now, you know, largely Chinese who come through that area. And Turks, and it's very few Mexicans, or at least that I've seen.
Yeah, and I think both of you have kind of spoken about this, just the changing face of migration. Gustavo, you talked about, you know, historically it was more like Mexican men, and that's, you know, that's transitioned to people from all – you mentioned Uzbekistan, all over. Gustavo, do you see that trend continuing?
Well, I think so. And you're right. I mean, I think I've brought this up before, but I think it's one of my few immigration fun facts when you look at historical stats, right? That OTM category where migration, it used to be like apprehended people were either Mexicans or OTM, which was other than Mexican. That's how common that group was. Yeah, we've seen – I mean, we continue to see other nationalities. I know in Tijuana they count them. Do you know what the number is? Like 180 something different.
Yeah, more than 100. Oh gosh, I have them here on my phone. But yeah, like in Tijuana, the airport, over 100 nationalities in the last 3 months of the year, and also, you know, they cross the border. What's interesting is San Diego, for some reason, has drawn a lot of these Eastern Hemisphere countries. San Diego and Arizona. Whereas I think, you know, Texas is, you see more Venezuelans and Mexicans, traditional Central Americans, the traditional nationalities. And I don't know why that is, but the numbers, I don't remember them offhand, but Gustavo mentioned that Border Patrol used to have Mexicans and other than Mexicans, OTMs. They do still have an other category that they have, but it's after about 20 other nationalities.
Yeah.
And it's and that category, the other category is one of the largest in the San Diego sector. I believe it's the third largest. So we're talking countries that are not even in the top 20.
And Elliot, I think you also have mentioned, you know, with this increase in migrant arrivals, you note that San Diego is becoming a busier area for those arrivals. I think the San Diego sector is now the third busiest. I think you said it's higher than it has been in past years. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember off the top. The numbers come out every month, and I usually memorize them, and I don't recall the January numbers offhand. But I do remember San Diego was third, just behind Tucson, which has been the busiest for much of the last, you know, 6 months or so. And Del Rio is another. These are the nine different regions, corridors in the Mexican border. Del Rio includes Eagle Pass, Texas, and that's where Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been really amping things up and you know, putting troops. He's preventing federal agents from even reaching the border in the town of Eagle Pass. So those two areas, Tucson and Eagle Pass, Del Rio, are ahead of San Diego. San Diego has always been a little bit, never the quietest, but much quieter. Right now it's busier than Rio Grande Valley and say in the southern tip of Texas, which has been the busiest for, you know, over a decade. And again, these are, like I was saying earlier, these are things that are hard for us to understand. I mean, it's the mm-hmm. smugglers deciding which is the most economic, who they have to pay off the least, what's this, you know, easiest, all kinds of calculations that we'll never really know.
So I do think that's pretty newsworthy, because the whole time I've been an immigration reporter, like, San Diego hasn't really been top of the list.
No.
And you get questions like, how crazy is the border? And my answer was always like, well, it's not like Texas.
And so just to be clear, it's not just the increase of you know, migrant arrivals that we've seen in the last couple of years, but the San Diego region has a greater share of arrivals
exactly.
compared to other parts of the U.S.-Mexican border, right?
Just to be clear. I think the numbers were down from January, from December, but they dropped even sharper. I think in Del Rio sector, it was, I want to say, 75% drop. It was a lesser percentage drop in San Diego, but it did fall. The Venezuelans dropped 91% in January from December. So for some reasons, Venezuelans did not cross that much in January. I don't know. What we look at is we look at how many people are crossing from Colombia to Panama through the Darien Gap,
mm-hmm.
how many people are crossing through Honduras, because those are all people who are coming up to the United States. They want to, at least. And those numbers went up in January. So that's from those crossing in Panama. So that makes me think this isn't going to last. This drop isn't going to last too long.
It might speak a little bit to maybe Mexican enforcement, right? They're getting to Mexico, not getting there. But I don't expect Mexico to sustain that level of enforcement very long.
No,
I don't think
people do. They don't have the money.
When Roundtable returns, we continue our conversation on migration and reflect on the last few years and what it's brought to the San Diego-Tijuana border region.
Feels like we're just in a situation of a constant crisis or just ready, like all hands on deck. It's like one emergency after another, and there's no real time to breathe.
That's coming up next on Roundtable.
Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.
You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. Today, we're talking about the state of the U.S. immigration system and the increased role the San Diego-Tijuana border region is playing in it. My guests are Elliot Spaggett from the Associated Press and KPBS's Gustavo Solis. Now, Gustavo, you've done, you know, we've talked a little bit about technology and the role that that's kind of plays here. Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of reporting on the CBP One app, which is a technology on the government side to handle asylum seekers. You've reported not only on the rollout of the technology and some of the bumps there, some of the problems that you found, but also its impact on the asylum system at large. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, well, just to recap a little bit, CBP One is this application that asylum seekers can use to kind of like pre-vet themselves before they make an appointment to cross the border. You need certain requirements to, you know, you obviously need a phone. You need to have a certain amount of, you know, tech savviness to use the app. You need to identify a sponsor in the U.S. who you can connect with. And it lets you set up an appointment so that instead of, you know, hiking out through Jacumba, you can just show up to the port of entry and cross. There were issues with the app really having to do with equity. You know, in the beginning, part of the process you have to take a picture. Folks with dark skin tones were having a really hard time getting the app to recognize their face. There were also, you know, a lot of people from more affluent countries and more affluent migrants, like Eastern Europeans, were getting the bulk of the appointments early on. But to the government's credit, they changed, you know, they've corrected some of the photo issues. they've given some priority to people who have been trying the longest to get the app. So it's working for folks who can do it, but it takes a certain amount of privilege to use that, right? In Tijuana, the officials there told me the average wait time is 4 to 5 months to secure an appointment. So you have to be willing to wait 4 or 5 months in Tijuana or in Mexico to get an appointment. You have to have enough money to do that. You have to feel safe enough to do that. And if you can, then it's a safer way to get into the country. But if you can't, then you know you're going to be hiking out and putting your life at risk because you're so desperate or you just don't want to wait that long.
Yeah, I think it's 1,450 a day that they allow in under that app across the border.
Yeah, in Tijuana, I've been told it's 400.
Yeah, me too. And the issue I have with it is, you know, it doesn't identify the most vulnerable. It's mm-hmm. It doesn't intend to. It doesn't pretend to do that. But you know, the people who are most vulnerable in need of asylum are not necessarily going to get the, it's like buying a concert ticket. You just you're you know, everyone's trying to get in and it's way oversubscribed. And you know, you just have to be patient to get it. Wait, what do you say? Four months.
4 to 5 months.
Or just say, hell, you know, forget this. I'm not waiting. I'm going to cross in Hukumba and get released in 2 days.
Yeah, which if you're desperate, kind of by definition, you don't have 4 or 5 months to wait.
Elliot, there have been some other recent changes on asylum. Can you talk a little bit about what you're finding there?
I think what you might be referring to is something I was looking into this week. Actually, a new asylum rule. Where it raises there's an initial screening that was introduced in 1996, and the standard is pretty low. It's generally considered like 10% chance of success, and the asylum officer will clear that initial hurdle. You get a court date. Cases are taken like 5 to 7 years to resolve. So that's an incentive for people with weak cases. They know that, you know, hey, even I'll get past the credible fear interview because it's pretty easy. What I found is it's in many cases is very rarely even done. So you just get a court date and you get 5 to 7 years right off the bat, even if you have a weak case. So, you know, there was this change to raise that standard to make it more difficult to a more likely than not standard that you're going to get asylum, that you'll need to do that to get past that initial hurdle. But it hasn't been applied. And it's just been, look, the numbers, I won't get into them, but the numbers are high. I mean, they did 130,000 of these interviews on the border last year, which sounds like a lot. It was double the previous years. But as I mentioned, 2 million illegal crossings.
That's a drop in the bucket.
It just hasn't really had much impact. And there was, if this is what you're referring to, there was, of course, the big discussion in Washington. It failed. I don't know if you wanted to get into that.
Yeah, let's get into that. So I think a lot of times when we've had you on before, the conversation inevitably at some point goes back to Washington, D.C. and the state of the federal immigration system and the lack of movement for federal immigration reform. But earlier this month, there was some movement. A bipartisan group of senators released an immigration plan that was quickly shot down by Republicans in the House and others. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on what it was like to see, you know, some movement at the federal level on this, and if there's anything you can take away, even if this effort did fail.
Well, I have a bunch of takeaways from it, I guess. One was it's important to keep in mind that it was tied to funding for Ukraine and Israel, right? So it was kind of used as an extra bargaining chip, which kind of tells you it's not a standalone priority if it can be bargained with something else. The other thing you mentioned, that it was a bipartisan, and it was. There was bipartisan agreement from it, but a lot of people on the left, I'm thinking progressives and really the immigrant advocate communities, were very unhappy for it. They described it as Democrats shifting right on immigration because they weren't really getting a lot of benefit from it, like expansions for undocumented folks or increased access to the asylum process. It was very much giving the Republicans what they wanted and not getting a lot of what the Democrats wanted. And I think that's something I think the Democratic Party is going to have to reconcile moving forward, is where they want to be on immigration.
Part of this plan, I think, was to end catch and release. I think it was also adding limits to your point of asylum and those arriving. Elliot, what are your thoughts on?
Well, yeah, I have a lot of thoughts, too. It was fascinating. I mean, just watching it like every day And my colleagues were like doorstopping these members of Congress for 4 months. And the result was, I guess, kind of predictable. I mean, it was dead on arrival, to use the phrase of the House Speaker. It died very, like, almost within a day or 2 days, maybe. But yeah, I mean, it was an attempt to create a political center on the issue, which is pretty admirable effort. I mean, the issue is just so, so polarizing. And the deal in the end was killed, not just, as Gustavo mentions, with the progressives, very upset, but just as, or maybe even more importantly, the Republican, you know, people on the right didn't go far enough. But, you know, basically what it did is it had some, you know, it was a tough bill, a tough agreement, you know, in the sense that it created a border emergency power for the president. So if illegal crossings got above a certain level, asylum would effectively shut down. And it also created these like super fast screening mechanisms where asylum officers, not immigration judges, would decide everything within, I believe it was 6 months instead of 6 years. And then they threw in some sweeteners about, you know, I think visas, and I can't remember what, but, you know, it was a complicated bill. But
the big one was the ambitious president shutting down the border.
Which, like, now they say he might do anyway. There's some reporting that he might do that anyways as an executive order. But I thought it was, you know, I'm not talking about the merits of it. I thought it was pretty well thought out. I mean, it did address the issues, whether you agree with their answers or not. It was relevant to today. It addressed what is happening on the ground today, which we haven't seen Congress do in ever.
A lot of pressure. I mean, they're getting pressure from cities like New York, Chicago, which they've never gotten pressure for on this issue. So I think a lot of it was trying to win people over in those cities and just kind of try to restore at least the appearance of order along the border.
Yeah, and the politics are like fascinating, and you know, my read is probably unsophisticated, probably off the mark.
Well, we don't cover politics.
But because I was talking with some of my colleagues about this, and they're saying, you know, Trump came out against it, which was really the death knell. And people said, well, he wanted to campaign on it, and he objected to that. He said, no, we thought it was a terrible bill. But now the Democrats, you know, Biden can say it was a winning issue for him, because even if he had signed it, he could say, I'm working with Republicans to address it. And if it failed, he could blame Republicans and say they're just using it for political gain, they're not serious. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how, you know, what's going to resonate with voters.
Well, and on the political note, I mean, there have been some recent polls that are pointing to immigration being pretty high on voters' lists. I think a recent poll from the Center for American Political Studies at Harvard and Harris Poll found that voters' top concern was immigration, even over things like inflation. Another recent poll from NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Marist found immigration was like the third top issue for voters. With that, you know, rising to the level, you know, of importance for voters, do you think that could spur more future efforts on immigration reform?
Possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely interest in it.
Yeah, there's big interest. Yeah, it's more among Republicans. The early voting states and primary caucus states, Iowa, New Hampshire, showed immigration was the number one issue ahead of the economy. My understanding, it's not quite as high among Democrats, but as Gustavo mentioned, it's, you know, all the large number of rivals in New York, Chicago, Denver, those mayors are speaking out constantly about it and how it's affecting their budgets. So, yeah, I think it's become definitely a bigger issue across the board.
Do you think it has become a bigger issue here, though? I mean, like, as you mentioned, as we've talked before, San Diego, our region is somewhat of like a transit area, like they head somewhere else. Do you get that sense? You're hearing more?
Locally, no, I don't get the sense. I mean, other than, you know, your Jim Desmonds or Bill Wells of the world, who have genuine takes of how the situation has been handled and the street drop-offs, like that's valid to them. But outside of that, no, not in the way you hear in other countries. I do think it's interesting that immigration gets talked about separate from the economy, because the two are very similar, especially if you look at some other aspects of immigration. If you look at labor shortage, there's been communication about increasing or reforming labor work visa laws to help out with that. There's a lot of research into the amount of money that immigrants can contribute to the country and don't take out because they don't qualify for a lot of social services. So I think, just me personally, that those are issues I kind of want to explore more, linking or the relationship between immigration and the economy, because I think that could be a really good way to educate people about sort of what's going on.
Yeah, we're gonna want to do a lot more reporting on that too. Because I mean, the reason asylum has taken off is because it's pretty much the only way to get in.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on the politics point, like the Republicans are the ones that are really running with immigration. Trump, Democrats, I think have been very uncomfortable with it, and a lot of divisions between progressives and others in the party. And, you know, you look at Biden, who himself has, you know, really, really struggled with the issue. He's called it a crisis. He called it a crisis. And, you know, we use the crisis, the C word, and Mayorkas Homeland Security started to use the word crisis finally after being pressed on it by Republicans year after year. So they're really struggling with it and trying to find a way to make it work for them, or at least not be a devastating strike against them.
Yeah, they're on the back foot of they're on the defensive on the issue, they don't really have a retort for what the Republicans are saying, which just really puts them in a really weak position, based on the politics of it.
Now, you both have covered immigration in the San Diego-Tijuana region for several years. You know, a lot of experience here. Can you talk about the significance of the last few years particularly? I mean, you mentioned Title 42, which we've talked about with both of you on this program before. I don't know, reflecting back over, say, the last few years of this period of immigration and increased migration, what are your thoughts on, you know, the last few years on this era?
I'm honestly surprised just by how long it's been sustained. You know, I'll admit I thought coming out of the pandemic, we'd see things go back to pre-pandemic levels and things, you know, quote unquote, go back to normal. Even when Title 42 was lifted, I thought there would be a big increase and then it would steadily go back down to normal levels. But I haven't seen that. I'm really surprised by how long this increased number has been sustained, and there doesn't seem to be an end to it. And it feels like we're just in a situation of a constant crisis, or just ready, like all hands on deck. It's like one emergency after another, and there's no real time to breathe.
Mm.
I've just been constantly surprised, and I think last time I was on the program, you asked what are your predictions for the coming year, and I said I'm not going to touch that one because it's just always. I mean, I didn't see Hakumba coming. I didn't see that. You know, I didn't see people from China coming for thousands a month crossing in San Diego. You know, it's just very difficult to predict what's next. But the forces are pretty strong. I mean, I don't know if. You know, Trump, if he wins, would try to come in and end a lot of this sort of carrot and stick approach that Biden has tried with CBP-1 and paroling people in, and then at the same time trying to crack down at people who cross illegally. He would try to pretty much shut it down, I think, to the extent he could shut down asylum. I don't know if that's even – I don't think it's possible.
I mean, it would shut down people from entering the country, but it wouldn't stop migrants from leaving
their
home
and trying. Yeah, the forces, especially you look at like Venezuela, which is a huge issue that merits its own discussion because that's – I mean, they were the number one nationality in September crossing the border. 7 million people, I think it's like a fifth of the country or something, have left.
Gosh.
Over 10 years. So, and there's no hope, you know, there's no hope of turning the corner there right now. So, the forces pushing people there are very, very, very strong. And then, of course, always the smartphone and people, technology, the ease of getting around. It makes me think that this will continue, but I wouldn't venture to say where, how, you know, and what, how much, you know.
I will say, I think some cities are getting more comfortable with it, or some organizations at least. I went to the Jewish Family Shelter Services, and they run a really good operation. They're coming at to almost 200,000 people that they've served and gone through their process, and now they have it figured out. So there are blueprints out there, maybe too few and far between right now, but people are figuring it out. And I think cities like New York and Chicago, the longer they're confronted with these problems, the more likely it is that they find a way to deal with them. But it's going to take everybody's effort, funding from the federal, state, local governments, philanthropy, and just people willing to do the work.
Well, we will have plenty to talk about going forward in the months ahead. I want to thank you both for being here. I've been speaking with Gustavo Solis, KPBS investigative border reporter, and Elliot Spaggett, San Diego correspondent and immigration team lead with the Associated Press. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
When we come back, we catch up on the top stories from the week with KPBS web producer Lara McCaffrey. Stay tuned. Roundtable is back in less than 2 minutes. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. It's time now to check in on some other top stories from the week, and joining me to do that is KPBS web producer Lara McCaffrey. Hey, Lara.
Hey, Andrew. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Good.
So what are some of the top stories you've been following this week?
So pocketbook issues are always a big popular topic with our readers. So the digital team, we have all our digital widgets that tell us like what stories are popular on the website. It's usually pocketbook issues, cost of living. So the big news this week was student loans. So the first batch of people that were enrolled in the Biden administration's SAVE plan, they got their student loan balances wiped. And on Wednesday, the Federal Education Department zeroed out loan balances for almost 153,000 borrowers. And the SAVE program was started last summer.
And the president has gotten some pushback on these efforts, if I recall, from Republican lawmakers. What's going on there?
Yeah. So Republican lawmakers, they've tried to stop the SAVE plan. They've argued that it's outside of the administration's authority. And they criticized the president for campaigning for votes with this policy. And he pretty much has been. He's done a 3-day swing in California campaigning. And that was one of his talking points, is his administration's student loan forgiveness efforts.
Well, and I guess, you know, as we just talked about earlier in the show, it is a presidential election year, and kind of these stories involving leaders, national leaders that have elections, you kind of have to look at it through that lens, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the latest on the campaign front is in the Chula Vista City Council race. So one of the candidates, the incumbent representing District 4, Andrea Cardenas, she resigned this week. Both she and her brother, Jesus, are facing criminal charges of fraud, grand theft auto, money laundering, and she was running for re-election.
Right, and this scandal has been building over the past few months, but now she finally ultimately resigned that position. So what happens to her seat now, do we know?
So from what I understand, they're looking for an interim position, but her name is still on the ballot. Ballots have gone out. And it's a little bit unclear what's going to happen if she gets voted back in, I guess.
And, you know, last time we had you on, we talked about the KPBS Voter Hub. And obviously, you know, we're all kind of focused on this election that's coming up. I think it ends on March 5th.
Mm-hmm.
Any other election news?
Yeah, the latest addition to the Voter Hub is our annual, well, not annual. Every time we have an election, we have a candidate quiz. And readers can take the quiz, answer, well, this year it's 4 yes or no questions. It's on issues from like housing, the stormwater system, how to fund that overhaul. And we ask local candidates the same things. So you can go into this interactive, and once you're done answering all the questions, you can look at how the candidates responded, and it'll tell you which candidates responded similarly to you. To be honest, like for me as a voter, it was pretty enlightening on how voters like stand with my personal beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, I remember doing this quiz at least one other election, and it is just helpful. Any way you can kind of get more information and tie it into your own beliefs, I think, is great. So that's something that I'll be looking at doing before I send my ballot in, which is sitting like on my desk right now as we speak.
Yeah, I think mine's under a pile of papers, but I'll get to it. I swear.
So I still think, so what are we talking? It's 2 weeks left?
Oh, yeah.
March 5th.
Yeah, it's coming up, coming in hot.
And, you know, another story, you know, we're drying off now from our latest atmospheric river. A lot of, you know, attention is still on the impacts from the floods of that January 22nd storm. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so actually KPBS did a community event with some South Bay leaders at the San Ysidro Public Library. That was on Tuesday night. And so we gathered them to talk about like what's top of mind as the election comes nearer. And then what dominated the conversation actually was flood recovery and the response to the flood. And as it relates to the election, people had a lot to say about the flood recovery. But as it relates to the election, flood victims, voting is going to be even harder for them this year. There's a lot of barriers to entry when it comes to voting. There's, you know, not having the time, the language barriers, people, you know, not understanding like how to vote or how to register to vote.
Getting to the voting center, like a lot of people have lost transportation. If you remember, a lot of people lost their cars in the floods.
Mm-hmm. Some ballots have got straight up like soaked. And you can get replacement ballots. We actually have a good article about that at kpbs.org. But some people just might not know what to do if their ballot's totally ruined. So there's all these existing barriers to entry. And the flood has just compounded these issues because people have a lot more, they have a lot more to worry about. You know, they have property damage, looking for a place to live, work issues. So it's just made things like elections much more complicated.
And kind of adding to that, I mean, now we've talked about this some on Midday Edition, others in KPBS have been reporting on it, sort of this new phase of flood recovery as some federal money might be coming in and FEMA is arriving. And just to navigate that can be pretty complicated. Have we seen federal assistance in San Diego yet? Has that help arrived?
So Biden just okayed FEMA money for people impacted by the January storm. And this money can be used for things like temporary housing, home repairs, low-cost loans for uninsured property losses, which there's quite a bit of that because not everybody has flood insurance or thinks about that in San Diego. And then I guess there's other programs to help people or business owners. So to qualify for that assistance, you have to contact FEMA. The number is 1-800-621-FEMA, or you can use the FEMA app and apply for your assistance there.
It's definitely going to be a long process there as, you know, people continue to try to repair their homes or get back on their feet.
Yeah, this problem is going to last for a long time, the recovery efforts, but we'll be here to tell you all about it.
So I have a couple I just wanted to throw your way here.
Yeah.
One thing I was reading was the San Diego Union-Tribune's Philip Molnar. He had a story on just the amount of like new apartments opening in San Diego. And I don't know if you felt this, but I've definitely been seeing a lot of bigger structures being built over the past, say, several months, I don't know, 6 months or so, like in my neighborhood. I think he says, you know, there are 50 new complexes being built around the county. The majority of them are in downtown San Diego, but there are examples elsewhere in the county as well. I saw another report that's saying, you know, condos, townhomes, those sales rose in January. But it remains to be seen, you know, with these new, you know, apartment complexes, will it have an impact on this housing crisis and the price of housing? Because again, you know, I have other friends like looking for a new place and it is not cheap and not easy.
Yeah. I'm in very beginning stages of possibly buying property and it is very complicated and a little disheartening. it's interesting that condos and townhome sales are going up because those are like the cheaper options, but there's all those HOA fees, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, but
I guess in contrast, I mean, the median price for a single family home is nearing that $1 million mark. I think it's $980,000. So obviously, you know, I think building these, you know, more townhomes, condos, you know, larger apartment buildings, we are seeing more of that. And obviously the region needs more housing.
Yep. The supply is very low. I forget what the numbers were, but there's, I think, only like 2,000, 3,000 homes like on the MLS right now. So there's not many available, and there's a lot of people here. So
finishing up on a brighter note, it sounds like giant pandas may return to San Diego Zoo, even potentially as soon as this year.
Yes, arriving as soon as the end of this summer, if all goes well, with whatever documents, permits, panda passports are gotten in order. So that's very exciting.
Also, there's sort of this higher level with the panda diplomacy, what they call.
Mm-hmm.
We had a segment on this on Midday Edition several months ago, but it was really interesting to see how you could kind of track the relationship of the United States and China to the number of pandas in the U.S. And so
yeah.
China's been taking back, over the last several years, have been taking back pandas. You know, the pandas that were here left in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
I think other zoos around the country also sent their pandas back. I think the last ones were in Washington, D.C., but
yeah.
Now there might be more coming back. So maybe that points to increased cooperation between the two countries, too.
Yeah, I guess so. Panda diplomacy.
Yeah, it's a real term. I didn't really
yeah.
know before we did that midday segment. But
so these two pandas, the ones they might send, they might be descendants of past San Diego Zoo pandas. Bai Yun and Gao Gao, if you're familiar.
Sounds familiar. I mean, I've definitely seen the pandas there. Yeah, it's like
mm-hmm.
when you have kids, I mean, that's like usually the first stop when they were here.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen the pandas like too often because there's usually a line. But
right.
I'll go to the red pandas. Or is that what they're called? The ones
yes.
that look like cats?
But yeah. I think that's great news. I mean, I think, you know, it's just a symbol of this relationship, but it's something we really associate with the San Diego Zoo and are kind of like proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be nice to, you know, if that can come together that quickly, too.
This is going to be a great summer, let me tell you.
Laura McCaffrey, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for this week. Thanks so much for being here. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org or leave us a message at 619-452-0228. You can always listen to our show as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays, again Sundays at 6 a.m. Roundtable's technical producers are Brandon Trufa and Ben Redlosk. This show was produced by Laura McCaffrey, and Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. I'm Andrew Bracken. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego, offering the online Master of Data Science program, shaping the next generation of data-driven problem solvers. Learn more about the online Master of Data Science program from UC San Diego at omds.ucsd.edu.